How do you go about making a shul? Let's say that we just want to make this house a shul. Like, we have 10 Jews, now this is going to be a shul. I mean,
well, that's how you do it.
That's it, right?
There's no magic formula. Anytime you have 10 Jews,
right,
you can make a shul. Now, I'm not advising you to do that necessarily, because it's good to have a rabbi. You know, I mean, theoretically, a shul can exist without a rabbi. But it's not a good idea, because without a rabbi, you don't have anyone to guide you.
So as long as you have a chazan leader and 10 men, you can keep the halachas, you can keep Shabbos to a certain extent.
Of course. But all I'm saying is, let's put it this way: if on an ad hoc basis you were 5 miles from a shul,
right,
and it was difficult for you, then if you can have your own service with 9 other people. But it's a little complicated because on Shabbat we read the Torah. You know, where are you going to get a Torah?
Right, where are you going to get a Torah?
I mean,
right,
you're going to have problems there. During the week, where it's not Monday and Thursday, you don't need a Torah, so you don't have that problem. You know?
Right, you can just drive, right? Then you just drive to the
farm. Or you can drive, yeah. But
miles away.
That's
right,
yes, yeah.
So the Torah is like the supreme law of the land. It's like our constitution. So basically, isn't it a little bit archaic for us to live our lives based off of the interpretation of rabbis separated by men thousands of years ago?
Well... You know, that's a very good question. But once again, number one, we have traditions about their great holiness. But number two, keep in mind that Jewish law is not static in that way. Meaning, although the Talmud is like the basic Supreme Court precedent, I mean, imagine, look at this analogy: Torah is constitution, and Talmud is the Supreme Court interpreting.
That's how I see it.
The constitution. But keep in mind that we also have, you know, modern rabbis. We don't change the law, but they kind of apply the law to new circumstances. So if today somebody asks me, you know, are you allowed to use electricity in Shabbat? You know, the Talmud gives you foundations, but it doesn't address electricity directly. So you have constant updating of the halacha to this very day, to the minute by minute. I mean, at this moment that we speak, there are rabbis.
That's why I need a Twitter.
Do you need a
Twitter?
Yeah.
I'm just kind of interested because I understand that everything from the Constitution of the United States or whatever, it's up for interpretation. But how can somebody be granted the power to actually change or write new rules for something that's supposed to be so?
Okay, so today, again, let me repeat. Today, there is no rabbi in the world who can make new rules. Everything is interpreting and applying the existing rules. But there was a time when there was a Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin, for an American, is a little confusing because in the United States, we're used to separation of powers. We have an executive, legislative, and judicial branch of government. The Sanhedrin is a little confusing on that paradigm because the Sanhedrin, which was a 71-member court, was a combination of a legislative body and a judicial body. It's as if Congress and the Supreme Court were united in the same body of people. Now, the Torah, which is our constitution, grants the Sanhedrin, this is in Deuteronomy, legislative power to make fences around the Torah, to make new laws around the Torah, as well as judicial power to interpret and apply halacha. So if you're asking the question, well, gee, isn't making new law a contradiction to the Torah that's divine? The answer is no, because the Torah that's divine granted this body those powers. A later Sanhedrin could repeal the decisions of an earlier Sanhedrin, just like, right? But the problem is, we no longer have a Sanhedrin that lapsed. It actually did not lapse with the destruction of the temple. It lapsed around 150 years, 200 years later. But we don't have it presently. And as a result, rabbis today are empowered to interpret existing halacha, but we're not empowered to create or innovate in that way. Yeah.
Why can't we make another Sanhedrin today?
You know, again, excellent question. There are some people that are trying to do so, but the reason why most halachic scholars feel we don't have that power is in order to have a Sanhedrin, you have to have what is called ordination. Now, although every rabbi has ordination, but I want to tell you, that I have fake ordination, because real no rabbi has real ordination today. Real ordination requires an unbroken transmission of authority going back to Moses. And it literally involved the laying of hands. Moses put his hands on 70 elders who became the first Sanhedrin, and every other Sanhedrin had this continuous laying of hands and conferral of authority. At some point in the Roman persecution, the last people who had that unbroken authority were killed off before they transmitted it to others. So literally, we don't have real ordination. And that will only come back when Mashiach, because Mashiach will be able to reinstate that practice. So lacking real ordination, we don't have the power to constitute a supreme Sanhedrin. And that's what most rabbis feel. Now, there is a minority view, and this would have real repercussions, that says that the sages of the generation, whether they have ordination or not, can recreate a Sanhedrin. And there are some people who are pushing for that, but that position has been rejected by most of the great rabbis.
I've asked my rabbi, and I've told him, would you rather me not go to shul or drive to shul and be in shul? Because from what I understand, God looks at each deed you do as a separate thing. And just because I drove, it doesn't mean I'm not getting the mitzvah of going to shul and praying. Right?
So what did he tell you?
As long as you're in shul, it's okay. We know whatever you have to do to get to shul, it's fine.
You know,
obviously it's wrong. Yeah. Obviously, but
this is one of the most difficult issues. You know, in an objective sense. I mean, let's take a fully Orthodox person. If a fully Orthodox person found himself in a situation where he'll either not go to shul or have to drive, then the answer for the fully Orthodox person is obvious. It is better to daven at home than to go to shul. Considerations are a little different when you're in the process of discovering the Shabbat, because the feeling would be that by your coming to shul and by your participating in the Shabbat meal, this may induce you in the long run to keep Shabbat. If you're not connected that way, you'll never advance any further. So there might be a difference between dealing with someone who's not yet fully observant, and this is a way of getting him there, versus the person who's already fully observant, and they're committed. If you're already committed, for sure, don't drive. There's no question. I mean, if I was in that situation, I would pray at home if I couldn't walk. But people in transition might have a different set of considerations. Okay, so it's a very complicated question.
We have just about 10 minutes left. Is the interpretation later after the Torah, or is it a tradition that came with Moses? Okay, so this is really asking really excellent questions.
The answer is, it is a composite of two different types of knowledge. There is a core of the oral law that God gave directly to Moses, that was not something that was innovated or created. It was literally passed down. A simple example is tefillin. We talked about tefillin the other day. Now, the Torah doesn't say tefillin are black or square. It doesn't tell you anything about it. But we know from the oral law that's what it is. However, there is another part of the oral law which involves subsequent interpretation of the Torah, like Supreme Court opinions interpreting the Torah, and that was not directly given to Moses, but that is the function of interpretation that accretes, that adds up with generation to generation. So part of the oral law is pure transmission with no interpretation added, and part of the oral law is interpretation and expansion, and part of the oral law, I'll give you a third component, is actually making these new fences around the Torah, is totally, later as well. Moses, God didn't tell Moses about these fences. These fences were added to enhance the spirit of Shabbat. So your point is very well taken. The oral law is not a unitary idea. It is a multifaceted idea. There's many different components. Yeah?
I have a question there. Is it a fundamental belief that I think if you could describe it would be extremely helpful to me and everybody else? that a lot of people say, rabbi, who gives this rabbi authority? What does this guy know that makes him so special? So through studying, you know, only through studying and seeing the wisdom that these men possess, they're almost like superhuman.
Yeah.
In the matter that they control their midot to a degree that we would think is almost impossible. So can you describe
what these men who had this authority,
uh-huh. You understand my question?
Yeah, I do, yes. Okay. Yes.
Describe so that they can feel what a Tana is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or a Rishon, or any of the holy men that had this authority, you can put it in some kind of description.
Yeah, you do have to understand, that's a very good point, that... the rabbis of the Talmud were human beings, right? They were not angels. They were not supernatural people. They were human beings who lived and died and the like. But the more you study their words, and the more you even see biographical details of their lives, you will see not only their brilliance, not only their mental acuity. What makes a great rabbi is not merely brilliance, although a great rabbi is brilliant, and the whole Talmud and everything else, but it's not just their brilliance, because you can have brilliant people in many, many fields. But it's the purity of their character, the holiness by which they live their lives, their absolute commitment both to God and to the Jewish people, in ways that are really beyond ordinary. You will encounter in the Talmud people of great, great, extraordinary holiness. And we can't even imagine what they were. But, even the rabbis today, and I don't mean the average rabbi, I'm talking about the great leaders of the Jewish people, are just very, very amazing in terms of their holiness. I hope you'll have a chance to meet some of them. Some of the people go to Rav Chaim Kanevsky in Bnei Brak, Rebbe Yashiv, who's 102, he's not well, unfortunately, he's in the hospital. But I'm saying, when you see rabbis of that magnitude, you're dealing with a qualitatively different type of human being. And you'll feel it. You'll feel it. I don't have to prove it to you. It'll be something that you will feel in the room. We had recently, the largest yeshiva in the world is the Mir Yeshiva. The Mir Yeshiva is located pretty close to Har Sinai, only around 15 minutes a walk. And the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva died this past year. He was in his mid-60s. And I just want to tell you something about him just to illustrate what type of people we're talking about. The Mir Yeshiva has 7,500 students, which is the largest yeshiva in the world. Its operating budget is $25 million a year. This Rosh Yeshiva was born in Chicago. He attended a co-ed Jewish high school. He was a White Sox and Cubs fan. But somehow, he got to Israel and he had transformations. And he eventually became, not only did he become the Rosh Yeshiva of the biggest yeshiva in the world, but he made it the biggest yeshiva. He took over a yeshiva that had 1,000 people. And over 25 years, he increased it seven and a half times. For 20 years, he suffered from extreme multiple sclerosis. I'm sorry, Parkinson's disease. He could not keep his body still. He could not walk or talk without agony and pain. He's a person who suffered every single day of his life. He took over a yeshiva. He increased it by 700%. He raised single-handedly $25 million a year.
Wow.
He knew and personally interacted with every student in the yeshiva. People would come to him for problems, for advice, for compassion. He would give people his bed. He would give people his food. And you talk about a person who worked, 18, 19, 20 hours a day with health problems that would have destroyed any other human being. And he was able to accomplish this. And when people would ask him in amazement, how can you do all of this with all of your suffering? And his response was, I'm not suffering. He says, I'm doing joyous work. I'm doing God's work. What is there to suffer about? And you see right away that you're not just dealing with a scholar. You're not just dealing with a rabbi. You're not just dealing with somebody who knows a lot. You're dealing with a different type of human being, a different type of person And that is really what we're talking about. And if you extrapolate that to the rabbis of the Talmud, you know, it's even greater, etc. So that's something to think about. We have to have a certain amount of respect and humility in the face of true greatness.
So rabbis are very influential people. They do a lot in society. Is there any kind of like test or any kind of like way to make sure they're of capacity to be a rabbi, like any kind of like LSAT, MCAT, something like Kadu, like American universities?
Yeah. No, it's a hard situation. There seems to be a sense that the Jewish people as a whole instinctively, that God almost puts a homing instinct into us, we instinctively gravitate to the people who are real. Again, there are many who are not real. There are many who might be brilliant minds, but they might have flawed character. We kind of collectively gravitate. You know, I'll just end here, because I know the hour is late, and we'll talk more about Shabbat, of course, on Shabbat and Shabbos. That's totally appropriate. But I want to tell you a story. One of the greatest rabbis of the 20th century was a very, very saintly man, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. He died 25 years ago. Now, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, and Rabbi Feinstein used to visit. I mean, he was really busy. I mean, he answered like every single question about the modern world. I mean, he was the one. They used to say that every rabbi got Rabbi Feinstein's phone number on the back of his ordination. So if he had a question, he could call up. So he was the one. So he wanted to spend a few weeks in Hartford because fewer people bothered him then, you know, so he could come to Hartford. So I remember as a 9-year-old, as I was just 9 years old, I remember Rabbi Feinstein coming to Hartford. And I had the privilege, on my way to school, I was on my way to fourth grade, I would daven in shul and then walk 2 blocks to school, and I was in the car that would take him to the synagogue. Little kid sitting in the car. And I would watch him, I would stare at him. He was very short little man. I was almost as tall as him. And one time it was raining, and I was still in the synagogue, and I was going to walk 2 blocks, no big deal. And after Rabbi Feinstein went home, the car came back for me, and somebody said, Rabbi Feinstein remembered you were in the car, and he didn't want you to walk in the rain, so he asked me if I would give you a ride to school. Now, you have to understand this. This is like the greatest rabbi in the world. This is like the busiest rabbi in the world. I mean, people bombarded him with questions, you know, 15 hours a day. And no one else noticed that a 9-year-old kid had to walk 2 blocks to school, and I didn't care either. So who was the one that bothered to notice that there might be a little difficulty for a little boy? That was him. So that's a very, very powerful lesson, that the greatest people pay attention to the least significant. That for a great man, nothing is too unimportant to be concerned about. So the point of the questioner is a very, very well-taken point. It's something that should be emphasized. Brilliance and knowledge are, of course, necessary conditions for rabbinic leadership. But they are necessary, but they are not sufficient. What needs to be there as well is kindness, compassion, love, caring about the Jewish people, and even caring about the whole world. And that makes a person a leader, and this is what you're going to find in a great, great, truly great rabbinic leadership. All right, so you take care. Have a good Shabbos.
Okay, guys, thank you, Rabbi Breidowitz. Hopefully we'll get a good amount of time to speak with Rabbi Breidowitz throughout Shabbos. Rabbi will be spending some time with us, hopefully. For now, let's all try to get on the bus. We're going to go shopping. So let's try to get there as soon as possible. Just go down and get on the bus, guys.
Thank you so much,
Rabbi.
Yeah.
I've been told you Hashem was created in the world, my cousin was kidnapped in Mexico.
Guys, come on.
When we talked to a rabbi, he told what's going on. And the rabbi says exactly where he was.
Daniel,
obviously, but he wasn't being tortured and all these things. So for my family, it was very important to hear. Thank God we got him back. Safe and everything.
So what do we
do? So I just
wanted to that's very beautiful. That the light was the spiritual light. Physical light is from the sun. The righteous have the spiritual light that allows them to see into the darkness of the world.
Thank you very much.
Oh, your cousin, you said?
Well, in Mexico.
So your cousin is safe?
Yeah.
Okay, glad to hear it.
Oh, the 6-week program. So they have a human class every week. Because then you can.
I'm not saying every day. I'm saying like across the day. What is this? How much is this? Hello. I can't understand.
It's amazing, huh? Is this rabbi? You see the light. It's amazing.
That's actually.
Yeah, you did. I feel like the highest maximum that people can fly.